geologists, we consider it very important to explain what we mean by saying a natural hazard, in that that is a phenomenon related to the Earth and the Earth's behavior. A disaster is created by the presence of a human population, their buildings, their infrastructure, and so on. And so what we're going to be looking at today is really the potential hazards that exist, and not so much from the disastrous implications. Actually, somebody up at the kiosk said they couldn't decide whether to come in here about possible hazards and disasters or existing ones in other countries in the world. So we will bring in the human element, because it's impossible for us not to have the human reaction in this discussion. But we'll really be talking about it from the geological perspective. I'll return to this concept of risk, though, later on, and how scientists try to evaluate what is meant by the risk of living in an area. So, if I could have my assistant turn on this light, Jeff, there's no way I can make my way back to it. Thank you very much. And is the person here today who fixed my slide projector yesterday? Thank you. I was busy. You laughed. I didn't get a chance to thank you. And I noticed you stationed yourself close to empty chair. We have a different slide projector today, so hopefully it'll work out. Well, I apologize. I didn't get to say thank you yesterday, so I'm glad you're here today. Okay, this is just a picture to start us all off, because it's a spectacular picture here. And as most of you probably recognize, this is a picture of Mount St. Helens taken after the eruption, after the mountain blew its top. And this is to remind us that many of us remember well that natural hazard that occurred in 1980 and reminded us all of the potential for such things here in the Pacific Northwest. But in order to get to a position where we can talk about this, again, I want to talk about the theory of plate tectonics. I want to spend a little bit more time on some aspects of plate tectonics. We kind of glossed over it yesterday. The theory of plate tectonics is one that has just fascinated me. When I was in high school, I started high school in 1970, so you don't count. I took an earth science course as a freshman in ninth grade. And I had a teacher who, you know, made us learn and memorize all the rocks and minerals. Somebody came up to me and said, that was the boring part of geology. And I agree, the rocks and minerals are not the thing that excited me. We learned about things, processes, and so on. But he told us about this theory that he said, you know, it was really hogwash. All these people were talking about the theory of plate tectonics. Well, it is now taught in our schools as fact, and it's not. It's a theory based on a tremendous amount of evidence and data and facts, but it's a theory to explain a tremendous amount of what we observe in the world today. And it's a theory that evolved in the mid-1960s with brains from all over the world kind of happening to be in the same place, same time, pulling together tremendous amounts of information, and really that which triggered the ability to move to this theory was the technological advances that occurred during the Second World War, particularly the ability to image and sample and make measurements on the seafloor, which two-thirds of the Earth had really been very inaccessible to scientists to that point. So the theory emerged in the mid-1960s, and I was fortunate in college to have professors who were just excited by this theory, and so fortunately my high school experience was mostly obliterated. What the theory says is that we have these pieces at the surface of the Earth. They're about 100 kilometers thick, 60 miles thick. They're very rigid material, and they move independently of one another. So we have an entire plate, such as this one, the Pacific Plate, which really moves as a single piece. Very little internal deformation. And adjacent to it, we see on this map all sorts of other plates. I'm extremely challenged by Alan's presence here, in that we have somebody who can't see these images. And now all of a sudden I find myself, I've taught the hearing impaired week up here. And that's a real challenge to have to, but those folks were seeing my images, and so now I'm gonna struggle a little bit with this. But the Pacific Plate, you can see, makes up most of the seafloor of the Pacific Ocean, primarily oceanic crust. In contrast, we have the adjacent North American plate, which includes not only the continent of North America, but half of the seafloor of the North Atlantic. And this acts as a single plate containing both continental and oceanic material. And these plates move independently of one another. Where these plates meet each other, and we'll talk briefly about the different types of places where they meet each other, we call these the plate boundaries. That is where, because of the motion of these blocks of rigid material, we find dramatic things happening in the world. We can see, and we'll come back and we'll look in more detail in a different image in a moment, but if we look here in the northeastern part of the Pacific Ocean, then we have the Pacific plate right up adjacent to North America, and we'll see shortly that in fact a tiny little piece of North America sits on the Pacific plate, and then there's this other little tiny plate up here between the Pacific plate and the North American plate, a plate that plays a key role for us. These plates are named for geographic features, and it's always fascinating to me. I always sort of do, you know, a matching thing on a test for students, the name of the plate, put the appropriate letter in for which plate it is. And there's very few of them that don't have something to do with the continent or the ocean, which is located there. And yet, the lack of geography background comes out strong when I ask them that question. So I work real hard with students to try and get a familiarity with these different plates. Okay, well then, as I said, the plate boundaries are the places where things happen geologically on the Earth. And this is a map that was created as a result of tremendous amount of surveying using sound waves in the ocean basins to get a sense of the depth of the seafloor. And then a scientist together with an artist worked to create a map that helps the world, the community of the world, have a vision of what the seafloor would look like if we drained the water out. Most of the maps which scientists use are simply maps which contour the depths of the seafloor, just as many of you have probably seen in topographic maps on land. Hikers use them all the time. But not everybody is comfortable with the interpretation of what all those little parallel lines mean on such maps. And so this image, these maps appeared in the late 1950s and into the 1960s, and National Geographic has made them very, very popular. They've been published in National Geographic a number of different times. But what we see if we look in the ocean basins in particular is that we see that there are some features which are very distinctive in their characteristics from the seafloor. Particularly, we see in the middle of the Atlantic, there appears to be sort of this mountain range that runs down the center of the Atlantic. A very symmetrical feature, happens to run down the middle of the ocean. It's then called the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. If we look into the Indian Ocean, we see similar feature, which has a Y shape to it here, section of it down here in the southwest part of the Indian Ocean, and the southeast part of the Indian Ocean, and those ridges are named just like that. And then up here, a section of it that extends up toward the Arabian Peninsula, and this section of ridge is called the Carlsberg Ridge. Does anybody know why? Because the Carlsberg Brewery funded the oceanographic. Some of them make lots of sense, and some of them don't. As we move here into the Pacific, we see that there's the same kind of feature, but it's no longer in the middle of the Pacific Ocean Basin. It's over here in the eastern part of the Pacific Ocean Basin. And one thing that looks a little different about it when we look in the Pacific is that it looks very broad and perhaps more gently sloping than the one that we see here in the Atlantic Ocean. Well, this feature, this ridge in the Atlantic, was described by scientists from Europe and from the east coast of North America who went out and did their expeditions, and they named this one the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. This feature here in the Pacific was described by scientists from the west coast of North America, and they named it the East Pacific Rise. We learned subsequently that they really have the same origin to them, but that the rise was simply the name one bunch of guys gave it, and the ridge was the name some others gave it, and it was a number of years before they realized that they were really, in fact, part of one continuous 40,000 kilometer ridge that we basically see extending through the ocean basins. Now, one of the other features that we see, particularly when we look in the Pacific, is that as we look around the Pacific, we see that adjacent to many of our continents, we have a very deep part of the ocean basin. It's very dark in coloring here. It's very narrow and very deep. And we can follow it up the west coast of South America, the west coast of Central America. It disappears here off North America till we come up to Alaska and out the Aleutians. And then we see it here not adjacent to continent, but adjacent to various of these ocean island chains that exist in the western part of the Pacific. And we can sort of follow these deep features all the way down here into the southern part of the Western Pacific. And these have been named the trenches. A couple other features that we see out here are islands in the oceans and seamounts, features that don't quite rise to sea level. And we see, in fact, places that there are chains of them, and the Hawaiian Island chain is perhaps the most famous of those. And we see some of those in other ocean basins as well. The only other trenches that we have in the world are here, the Java Trench in the Indian Ocean, and the small Scotia Trench in the South Atlantic, and the Puerto Rico Trench in the North or Central Atlantic. The Pacific, then, is where we see this dominance of trenches. And that has a tremendous connection to what we're going to move on and talk about today. Three types of plate boundaries, and it was really the vision of a map like this that made scientists be able to say, wow, there are these features that are uniform throughout the ocean basins, and maybe they're a clue to something that's going on. The first paper that speculated about how these all might be interrelated was published under the title of Geopoetry. A scientist who had served on board a ship in the Pacific during the Second World War had observed all of this and had the ability in his mind to sort of synthesize all this information about the depths of the seafloor. But he really wasn't willing to publish it as a true theory, but just as a brief speculation at that point. So our three types of plate boundaries then. We have places, well, we can see the top there. It's more important what's down here anyhow. We have places where the plates appear to be moving apart. In the modern day, we can actually make measurements to prove to ourselves that those plates are very slowly moving apart. But we also have a tremendous amount of evidence down here preserved in the seafloor. And it was the use of that data from the seafloor, measurements of the rocks and their characteristics, that really was the cornerstone of the theory of plate tectonics. When two continental pieces separate, the new molten material that comes up to fill the space in between them creates not more continental crust, but creates oceanic crust. So when we have them moving apart, we create a new ocean basin. The Atlantic is in a stage where these two continental blocks have separated a great distance. These ridges where we see this separation have some fascinating characteristics associated with them. Some of you may have seen some of the NOVA programs or something on these hydrothermal vent communities that exist down at these mid-ocean ridges. Hot water is cycled through the rock and emerges out of these features that are chimneys coming up. And as the hot water encounters the surrounding cool water, minerals which were dissolved in it precipitate out, forming these features which are called black smokers. And it also supports this entire community of organisms which have no dependence on sunlight for their food chain. And these are tube worms. They stand 2 to 3 meters high. Very hard for us to get a sense of scale when we look at these pictures. So at our ridges, we see these kinds of communities. The first was only discovered in the late 1970s, and we've now found them throughout the world on our ridges. One place in the world, our oceanic ridge happens to be above sea level because of sort of an extra process going on, and that's at Iceland. Some of you may remember the eruption of Surtsey in the early 1960s. Surtsey was a small island part of the sort of chain of islands that make up Iceland. And it reminded us that those ocean ridges are active. This is just a view down the fissure zone of the eruptions on the main island of Iceland as well. And then just to remind us that we have some new ocean basins forming where there are divergent plate boundaries, we have here Sinai Peninsula and Africa, and this is then the Red Sea, which is only about a 20 million year old ocean basin, slowly separating these different plates. This is the Arabian plate from there on over, and this is the African plate. If we wait long enough, this can resolve some of our political problems. One of the other types of plate boundaries that we have is one where the plates are simply sliding past one another. where the blocks of material are moving in different directions, not toward each other or apart, but simply sliding past. And we have what we call a transform plate boundary, usually not a single fault, but a series of parallel faults that make up this boundary. And the most famous of these is the San Andreas Fault. And when you look at this picture taken of the Carrizo Plain, you can see this fault line here and the offset. One of the things you can do is follow these stream channels and see how offset they are along this fault line. That's North American plate. And that's Pacific plate. Two different plates. Los Angeles sits on the Pacific plate. San Francisco sits on the North American plate. San Diego's on the Pacific plate. For years they used to say, you know, everything in California is falling off into the ocean. It's not falling off into the ocean, it's heading for Alaska. And they'll be thrilled, won't they? Northern Californians are most dismayed at the thought of Southern Californians becoming closer. And then our third and most important type of plate boundary in our discussion today is that of a convergent plate boundary where two plates are coming together. And obviously, as this image here of the puzzle piece shows us, you can't put the two plates in the same place. Something has to happen, and the most dramatic thing that has to happen is that one of the plates usually gives way and bends and goes down beneath the other plate and does what we call subducts beneath it. But there's actually three different kinds of scenarios, depending upon what type of crust we have at the surface. If we have oceanic crust coming together with continental crust, the oceanic crust subducts, and similarly, if we have two oceanic plates, one of the oceanic plates subducts. Which one? We still don't think we can necessarily predict that. If instead we have two plates coming together that have continental crust has a lower density, it's more buoyant, it can't subduct. And instead what we have is these two coming together and just scrunching everything in between, creating dramatic mountain ranges such as the Himalayas. Basically taking two pieces of continental crust and stacking all of that material together, deforming it in between. The Alps are another location where this is taking place, and then the Appalachians are an ancient example of where that took place.
How about the Rocky Mountains?
The Rocky Mountains are the enigma of geology. There is no good explanation for why the Rocky Mountains are there. We don't have a plate boundary where the Rocky Mountains are. That's the middle of the North American plate. There's a lot of work that's been done to try and get a sense of what's going on, and perhaps what we have are the remnants of an old subduction system. We know 50, 60, 70, 90 million years ago, we had subduction of oceanic crust beneath North America, all the way down the west coast of North America. That's what produced the Sierra Nevada Mountains, for example. Those are the remnants of that previous thing. Maybe what we have is some remnant of this collision still being felt internally in the North American plate. Some small amount of relative motion between continental pieces. It's not dramatic convergence the way we can measure it in other places. It's what keeps geologists employed, though. Now, there are a number of different examples of these. The kind of example we're going to be talking about today is that of oceanic crust beneath continental crust. However, in the Pacific, there are other places where we have oceanic crust subducting beneath other pieces of oceanic crust. And the eruption of Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines was a dramatic reminder of that convergence between those plates. Now, if we can't remember if I put the slide in here or not. And, oh, I didn't want to get to that yet. Okay, let's look here, and I hope everybody can sort of tolerate that we still have a shadow of that other image there. I don't want to turn things on and off all the time here. But if we look here at the western part of North America, we talked briefly about this movement here between the Pacific plate and the North American plate, and this piece of continent of Southern California moving relative to North America. But the area that we're really most interested in is up here, the Pacific Northwest region, where we have the Juan de Fuca plate subducting beneath the North American plate, and that's what this image up here shows us. And this image helps us to remind us of the kinds of features that we associate with this convergence between an oceanic plate and a continental plate. One of the most notable is that as the material is subducted, it is warmed as it comes down here into the mantle region, and we have melting of this material. This molten material, this magma, is less dense. It then rises up to the surface and produces the volcanoes that we see up at the surface. So, where we have subduction of one plate beneath another, one of the most common things that we find as evidence of that are the volcanoes. And fortunately, volcanoes and the material which comes out of volcanoes is preserved in the geologic record. So we as geologists can use that to try and go back in the past and locate ancient regions of convergence between two plates 200, 300, 400 million years ago. But also think about the fact that we know that when two plates slide past one another, that we get earthquakes. San Andreas Fault keeps us reminded of that. But we have two plates sliding laterally here. We've got two plates moving past each other up here in a subduction zone as well. And so one of the other things that we have here is earthquakes. So where we have subduction zones, we have earthquakes, we have volcanoes. The problem with earthquakes is they don't preserve very well the geologic record. They may preserve in the human record in that we may see a city that was entirely demolished and the rubble of that may show up for archaeologists to evaluate. But we have a very difficult time identifying past earthquakes as we look in the geologic record, although we'll return to that later on. Okay, so what we want to do today is focus then on the Northwest region and look at the earthquakes that have occurred in the region, the volcanic activity in the region, and what this may present for us in the future in terms of potential hazards that we may be facing. The region of the Pacific Ocean, as we go all the way down up the coast of South America, around North America, and then all the way over to the western part of the Pacific, is all called the Ring of Fire. And that's because of all the volcanoes that we find along the edge of the land masses. This ring of volcanic activity. In our case, the name that I gave for this talk is Living on the Edge, because we're living on the edge of the North American plate. And that's the hazards that are presented for us. And notice, though, that if we look at this is a nice peaceful picture of Mount Redoubt in Alaska, but remember that it erupted not too long ago and keeps people in Alaska reminded that they live on the Ring of Fire as well. And an image here of the collapse. Man, I guess I have to have one slide in every time that's wrong. It must have been when the little child came and asked me a question when I was organizing it. But this is a picture, unfortunately, of the collapse of a freeway in Kobe, Japan. And I'm sure all of you remember the Kobe, Japan earthquake. It reminded all of us of the potential for these very large earthquakes and the damage that can occur from them. Loma Prieta, the San Francisco earthquake of 1989, if anybody was watching the playoffs of the World Series, then you certainly were aware of that. And people who have spent time in other parts of the world may have experienced earthquakes themselves. Here in the Pacific Northwest, we've been sort of pampered by not experiencing too many of those earthquakes. But we'll return to that. Okay, so as I said, two plates meet. Oh, here it is. I think we have it after all. We have the subduction, we have melting of this plate as it's subducted, and we have volcanoes. And that's what I want to spend some time on right now, is talking a little bit about these volcanoes. Yesterday I spent some time. Excuse me.
Melting from internal heat or friction?
It's from the heat of the layer into which it's going down, and the fact that this material, as this plate moved through the ocean basins, accumulated sediments. These sediments have a tremendous amount of water in them, and the presence of the water here as it goes down into a warmer region caused this material to melt more readily. The presence of water speeds up that melting process. So it's partly from pressure, it's not from friction, it's partly from pressure and from the surrounding heat. of the region into which it's penetrating. And yesterday I talked some about the type of volcanism that we find in this area. Many of us are familiar with the peaceful, gentle eruptions of Hawaii. People can go film them, you can go and stand there and look at them. And the material which has erupted there is basalt. The silicon content of basalt is low, it flows easily, it flows gently, it's able to emerge out of the earth with some regularity, doesn't trap a tremendous amount of gases. Here, partly because we're taking down and incorporating this material here from the sediments and the waters, the chemical composition of this material and the continental crust as it comes up through the continental crust gives the chemical composition of the material erupted in this area a very different chemical composition. Lots more silica. All those little silica atoms love to attach themselves together with each other. Gives us a really thick, viscous lava. It doesn't want to flow easily. It gets stuck in the plumbing of the volcano, traps a tremendous amount of gas, and so when these volcanoes erupt, they're very, very explosive. Tremendous amount of gases come out with them, and as a result, we have very explosive eruptions. Sometimes we have some lava flows, very, very thick, viscous lava. Other times, we just blow out all the material that was there in the magma, and as it encounters the atmosphere, it cools and falls as small particles of ash and pumice, rather than flowing out as a lava. If we look at the eruption of these kinds of volcanoes, the U.S. Geological Survey has put together an image to try and show us the types of potential hazards from an eruption of a volcano. And we see that there are many such hazards. Not only do we have an eruption potentially of ash and steam, and that may be blown elsewhere, and so that we have our ash falling, not right at the mountain, but some distance away. But we may, as instead of this material blowing directly up, it may actually flow down in a cloud of this hot, loose particles that flow down in something we call a pyroclastic flow. Pyro, I mean, the root. Many of us are familiar with in terms of fire, very, very hot flows. And the island of Martinique in the Caribbean had such an eruption back in the 19th century. And the narratives that a few survivors give of that was very dramatic. This cloud of super hot gas and particles came tearing down the mountainside into the city. Some of the other things you see, ash. The word tephra refers to these small particles of fall. You can have ash, you can actually have larger things, pumice all the way up to pieces that are described as bomb size. And as we talked about yesterday, if you've got water trapped here at all on top of the volcano as ice or as snow, you may have mudslides then. As this material falls down, the water, the ice and snow melts and you end up with these mudslides. So a variety of these different kinds of hazards from an eruption, not lava flows in the sense that we think of it in Hawaii, but these much more explosive eruptions. And Mount St. Helens reminded us of that in 1980. We talked some about this yesterday, that geologists have been studying the various Cascade volcanoes, and we saw that Mount St. Helens has certainly been very active over the last 4,000 years. All of these volcanoes have been built only in the last 1.5 to 2 million years. And we see that while we don't think of many of them as being presently active, if we look down, there are a few that have actually been active in the last 100 to 200 years in the time of settlement by whites in the Northwest. But if we look back at the geologic record, we can find a tremendous amount of evidence that nearly all of these Cascade volcanoes have had some form of activity in the last 4,000 years.
Is that what happened to Mount Mazama in Oregon?
That's correct. 6,600 years ago was Mount Mazama. I'll say just a little bit more about that in a moment. Here's this beautiful pre-eruption image of Mount St. Helens. And then as we move forward, as I talked about yesterday, we had a three-part eruption. Following this growth of this huge bulge on the side of the mountain, that side of the mountain collapsed on May 18th, followed by a huge blast part of the eruption, and ultimately this ash column. And this eruption then taught us a lot about a volcano having not only one type of hazard associated with its eruption, that we not only have huge amounts of material sliding down the side of the mountain, but that we may have this blast of very hot gas and particles, or we may also have this eruption of this tall ash column, which then transports this material many miles away. So a single eruption may have all these different phases to it. That is the mountain up there, the crater in there, and this just is a sense of sort of the devastated area as we move away from the volcano. The blowdown of trees, the tremendous amount of mudslide material that came down off the summit of that volcano. And then, again, beautiful after images, but here still showing a little bit of a steam eruption and the growth of this new dome to remind us that Mount St. Helens isn't finished with what it's doing. And Mount St. Helens, as I said yesterday, was really relatively small compared to what we believe has happened in prior Cascade volcanoes. Mount Mazama, the name that the natives gave to the mountain that existed down in southern Oregon, blew its top in the same, probably in very much the same sort of an eruption as Mount St. Helens 6,600 years ago, but of a much, much larger magnitude. Perhaps 30 times as great in terms of the amount of material which came out of it. 10 cubic miles of material blew out of that, leaving us with this crater at the summit of what was once a very tall mountain. And then Mount Lassen, and this image here of Mount Lassen is taken from a parking lot as you drive up into the national park. And in 1914, 1915, this entire parking lot area was the site of a very, very large mudflow off the summit of Mount Lassen. And what I'll be talking about in terms of Mount Rainier on the weekend, and in just a moment here we'll talk a little bit about it, is that the mudflows are something that are perhaps the greatest threat of our Cascade volcanoes, but until the last decade or so have not been given the fair amount of attention. I mean, it was the eruption of Mount St. Helens and all its drama that caught people's attention, and sure, the people in the Toutle River Valley and the Cowlitz and the Columbia were aware of the mud flows, but not in the same way that we need to be thinking as we look at today's mountains. Mount Rainier, as this image reminds us, sits very, very close to population centers. I still find myself in awe as I drive around the Tacoma area that mountain is rising up there in front of me. And I know that every tourist who comes to the Seattle-Tacoma area on a clear day has an equal amount of awe. And yet it sits very close to us. And that presents a tremendous threat to us. Not because Mount Rainier is expected to have a blast eruption the way Mount Mazama did 6,600 years ago, or the way Mount St. Helens did 17 years ago, but because Mount Rainier is probably one of the older Cascade volcanoes, and it's in a phase where the rock material of that mountain is aging. There is no sign of active movement of magma beneath Mount Rainier at this time. It's believed that the mountain reached its maximum height potentially 2,000 feet higher than it is today, so perhaps about 16,000 feet high. It's believed it reached its maximum height about 75,000 years ago, and that like Mount St. Helens, it blew its top. And if you look at the shape of this volcano, you can sort of follow the flanks of the volcano up and see that it has a relatively flat top compared to the shape that we expect. And so geologists have sort of extrapolated it up another couple thousand feet. 6,000 years ago then, it's believed to have blown its top, and we'll talk about what those eruptions may have produced. Presumably the ash and the blast type of eruptions, potentially, that we see here before. And then in the summit of this, we have built a new cone here in the summit of Mount Rainier. Well, the Columbia Crest, a very small cone, not expected by geologists to reach the full size that the summit of the mountain once had. Mount Rainier is covered by, and this is an image that shows you then this new cone which is formed. It's slightly out of focus and I apologize for that. But this region of the mountain here the old summit collapsed down in this direction, away from the summit, a huge landslide, just as Mount St. Helens eruption is had in 1980. And we'll look at the implications of that for the surrounding area. One of the things that makes Mount Rainier a great hazard is the fact that it's covered by 26 glaciers. Tremendous amount of storm water in the glaciers and the ice and the snow that are on the summit of that mountain. And we know that even today, up here at the summit at Columbia Crest, there are steam vents and small fumaroles. So we know there's still some heat, not active movement of magma, but heat making its way up to the crest of that volcano. And if we had a pulse of more heat, that would present a tremendous threat here to all of the area, because all of this stored water has the potential to melt. No eruptions of this mountain in the last 100 years, no ash eruptions, no blasts of steam, as we've seen with some of the other Cascade volcanoes. But we know that when that mountain blew its top, that the material that made up the summit of that mountain, and if you go to Sunrise, which is where you get the best view sort of where the summit fell away, you look up at the summit of the mountain, and the river valleys away from that summit transported enormous volumes of water and loose debris that was part of that, as that side of the mountain collapsed. And mud flows, the Osceola mud flow. Now, every USGS image that I see has a different date here. And most geologists place it somewhere between 5,700 and 6,000 years ago. I don't know whether this was their typo, but in any event, as the summit collapsed, the water, it liquefied, and together with the loose material that collapsed from the summit, traveled down these river valleys out all the way to Puget Sound. And geologists believe that the mouth of the Puyallup River sat at Puyallup up until 5,700 years ago. And that the remaining stretch of the Puyallup River down to the present-day Tacoma Tide Flats filled in as a result of this Osceola mud flow when the summit of that mountain collapsed. And as I said yesterday, right there, the Puyallup Valley. Many of you who are from the state of Washington may have been to the Western Washington State Fair held in Puyallup. They were doing some hole digging recently, about 5 years ago, to put in some new sewer pipes, and the geologists were just thrilled because they as they dug down, they came upon a terrific exposure of the Osceola mud flow. So they had to halt the construction for a while, so geologists could go in and study it and so on. So there's great proof in the geologic record that the Osceola mud flow went that path. The Electron mud flow, a smaller mud flow, about 500 years ago, did a similar thing, flowing down from Mount Rainier, and again, not making its way out to the Puget Sound, but down to the community of Ording. And it's estimated that it took about an hour for the mud flow to make it from the summit to the community of Ording. People who live in the Seattle-Tacoma area may be aware that Ording is the only community doing anything about planning for such a possibility. And they do all sorts of things. They do evacuations of their kids from their schools, and they have an evacuation route up to the higher areas. If you live in Puyallup and South Hill, you're just fine. It's just those of us who live in the valleys that have a problem. So they have worked very hard. So as we look at Mount Rainier, the threat of Mount Rainier is that this old volcano, the material that makes up that mountain is not solid, firm rock anymore. It's rock which is weathered, been exposed to the elements, and is now, geologists want to call it rotten rock. So that if we have any sort of a process that melts those glaciers and gives us water, that we have the potential then to mix that water with this rotten rock and produce these tremendous mud flows that we certainly have evidence from in the geologic record. So then the other thing I want to talk about is earthquakes, and we'll talk less about earthquakes than I might have, so we can have some discussion. But as we look around the world, we see that our plate boundaries are the sites of earthquakes. All these little red dots outline for us the ridges in the ocean basins, and outline for us the ring of fire here around the edges of the continents, all around the Pacific Ocean, and we see that if we look right up here, there's a few earthquakes. Not a lot of earthquakes, there's a few earthquakes. And we want to talk about why there's some, but why there aren't quite so many. When we measure earthquakes, there are two ways to describe earthquakes, and some of you may have heard both terms or one or the other. When we talk about Richter magnitude of an earthquake, we're talking about an actual physical measurement that we can make of the amount of energy released by an earthquake. And we do that measurement with a seismograph. This is sort of a dark image of a seismograph. Many of you may have seen a seismograph drum. There's a little pen, and as the sensors pick up motion, the pen wiggles. And seismographs are used throughout the world to sense earthquakes. Very sensitive seismographs can pick up earthquakes on the other side of the world. The other scale which is used to describe an earthquake is called the Modified Mercalli Intensity Scale. It's not measuring the magnitude, the size of the earthquake, it's measuring the intensity of what is felt by people. What amount of shaking, what amount of damage you experience. And a given earthquake only has one magnitude, but it has many, many intensities. The people living closest to where the earthquake took place experience the highest intensity of shaking and damage, and the people living further away experience smaller intensities. And you can see here some of the descriptions of the different kinds of things that are felt by an earthquake when we get up to the very large earthquakes, total damage. People actually see the ground as it moves. When we look here at the middle level, we see maybe slight building damage, those that are felt by everyone, those that are felt by most, and so on. And in the Pacific Northwest, we tend to have had, in the last couple decades, intensities down sort of 7 and lower in terms of what people have actually experienced. I'm going to move over here to looking at some overheads. And if we look here at the Pacific Northwest, we see earthquakes locally. Certainly we have earthquakes delineating the boundary between the Juan de Fuca plate and the Pacific plate, our divergent plate boundary. But we also see a certain amount of earthquakes occurring here on the continent beneath this, where this plate is subducting beneath North America. If we look in a little bit greater detail at the Puget Sound area, well, of Washington and Oregon in particular, and we look at the historic record of earthquakes, where people have been able to actually measure them, and notice here that what we have is the location, which is called the epicenter of an earthquake, and then we have them given in terms of the maximum intensity that was felt. Because if we go back to 1872, we didn't have any seismographs to measure it. So we're comparing these earthquakes based on the intensity of what people felt. We see that we get up to maybe an intensity 8 or somewhat greater than that. And if we look, most of them, though, are much smaller than that, much lower intensities. And there's only two that really stand out in the historic record in the Puget Sound area of 1965-1949 as having been earthquakes of any great note. In 1949, the Richter magnitude of that earthquake was 7.1. The epicenter was very close to Olympia. 8 people were killed, and they were killed by what?
Falling
masonry. Why? Because they went outdoors. When there was a small earthquake in the Puget Sound area about a month ago, my husband's coworkers all were running for the doors. And he said, why are you going outdoors? When you go outdoors, you're outside where everything falls down on you. If you stay inside, particularly inside where under a table or in door frames, you're far better protected than outdoors. And it was the loose masonry facings of buildings that collapsed on people and caused the damage. That earthquake was actually felt all the way from Oregon up into British Columbia and as far east as Montana. The 1965 earthquake was slightly smaller, a magnitude 6.5. The epicenter a little further north near SeaTac. Again, the people who died were either from falling masonry or people who experienced heart attacks. One of the more dramatic things that happened was the 2 beer tanks. And it was estimated that in 1965, the damage from a 6.5 earthquake was $12.5 million. Now, if we look since that time, we can see that there's not much since that time. Some people who and I have a couple other images that we'll look at that show some other numbers here and dates, but some of you who live in this area know that we've experienced some other earthquakes, not as large as either of those earthquakes. If we look at earthquakes, this is, that's pretty much the same thing. This is an image that shows us earthquakes which have occurred, sort of the last 10 or 20 earthquakes that occurred up through just July 17th. And we see that there are some earthquakes here in the Puget Sound area. One which was located out here very close to Bremerton. Another one which was over next to, in the Okanagan area. Now, how many people here live in the Skagit-Tacoma area? This is typical. Half the people are older from Minnesota, the other half. January 1995, sort of very close to Martin Luther King Day, there was an earthquake which many people experienced, an epicenter fairly close to Federal Way, and that was a magnitude 5. And anybody who lives in that area may remember some damage from that. You have?
Well, no damage, but if I had moved a plate that morning, it would have been.
And there were pictures on, I'm sorry, I lived in Southern California for a while. There were pictures on the news, and they're making a great big deal out of the 10 bottles of ketchup that fell in the grocery store. Or the one China store that experienced damage. And there was some damage. My house, because I lived down the Puyallup Valley, on loose fill from mud flows and river deposits, shakes like a bowl of jelly. We actually had some things fall off of the top of shelves, and our next door neighbors had a small amount of cracking of plaster. And we're, 10 or so miles from where the epicenter was. It shook enough that we went and stood in the doorways and our kids wouldn't be in a different room from us for about a month after that. to accustom themselves to it. Another earthquake that many people probably remember is the May 1996 earthquake, which was in Duval, up here some northeast of Seattle. That one made the national press because the Mariners game was stopped. It was not as big an earthquake. It was just slightly larger, 5.3, but in a less populated area, much less reported damage from that. And then this spring, all of a sudden, we had some earthquakes. And that built up a tremendous amount of excitement again. Earthquakes, just sort of 4.5 to 5 in magnitude. Couple here near Bremerton, there were some tales in Bremerton of some damage there, and then the one over in the Okanagan area. And of course, once again, it got the press discussing earthquakes. And from my perspective, that's very good. We need to be kept aware that we live in an area with potential for earthquakes. The problem is, the earthquakes that have been experienced by people in this area are relatively small compared to what the geologic community believes we're due for in this area. Now, somebody yesterday asked me, and I'm just going to briefly show this. There are some earthquakes, small earthquakes associated with Mount Rainier, the summit of the mountain. There's some beneath the summit, small, not attributed to movement of magma, but just sort of shifting of the internal aspects of the mountain. And then some zone where there's a bunch of earthquakes to the west. Gives geologists something to do to try and figure out why there's this zone of earthquakes in the west. If we look at the activity beneath the summit of Mount Rainier, we see it's very small and very shallow compared to what was experienced beneath Mount St. Helens before its eruption. So probably not a threat, but if we were to get some greater amount of seismic activity beneath Mount Rainier, that would present a problem for us. Okay, but if we look at the geologic evidence, and earlier I said there is no such thing as geologic evidence for an earthquake. It's not quite true. If we look at evidence for fairly recent earthquakes, maybe the last few hundred years, we can look for some evidence. When we start looking back, much further back in the geologic record, it's very hard to distinguish what may be evidence for an earthquake. But a number of years ago, an employee of the U.S. Geological Survey moved to the Seattle area, and he was looking for a project, and he was a great outdoors person. He took upon himself to start looking in the coastal areas for any evidence that the coastal areas of Washington and Oregon had experienced any dramatic uplift or subsidence, very sudden uplift or subsidence. And he believed that this might in some way be associated with these two plates converging and the slipping of one plate compared to the other, and that would produce some flexing of the upper plates, which in some areas would produce uplift and in other areas would produce subsidence. So he went out into the coastal marshes of Western Washington and discovered that there were places where there was a sudden deposit of sand, and I have no very good image of this, but a sudden deposit of sand between layers that were very muddy. And the very muddy fine grain material is associated with very quiet water, coastal marshes. The sand, he believed, was due to a tsunami. Now, a tsunami is not a tidal wave. It's not produced by the tides. It has nothing to do with the tides. It's the name the Japanese use for a seismic sea wave. A large wave at sea created by rapid, sudden movement of the Earth's crust at the near sea level. And the great earthquake of 1964 in Alaska produced one of these very large tsunamis. The major earthquake of 1960 in Chile produced a tsunami that killed people in Japan. But tsunamis locally will transport suddenly large amounts of water and particles. And he believed that these sand deposits were attributed to the area suddenly having a large motion that was able of water, which was able to transport a much larger particle material as sand. And so he went out and looked at these buried layers and found all sorts of evidence, he believes, and the geologic community has gone out and looked at these in many other locations, and when they can date them using radiocarbon dating, they find that these events were synchronous up and down the West Coast, suggesting that this was a major event, not a very isolated event in one marsh, but something that occurred all the way up and down the West Coast. And they attribute these to having been associated with much larger earthquakes than any that the Puget Sound region has experienced since the settlement of whites. Many of these, he believes that on the order of every 20 years, we can have earthquakes of the magnitude perhaps of 6 or 7, but that on the period of about every 300 years, the Puget Sound, or Western Washington, Western Oregon, probably have experienced earthquakes on the order of a magnitude 9. Oh no, every 500 years, a magnitude 9. The last one, the evidence says, was 300 years ago. Good, it won't be in my lifetime. That's right, except what does it say? It says it's an average of every 500 years. Not that it happens every 500 years, but an average of every 500 years. And so one of the things that geologists have tried to do is to estimate the risk from an earthquake. And throughout the U.S., there's been an enormous effort to do this, to pinpoint the areas of the U.S. that are set for expected risk from an earthquake. And Southern California comes as no surprise to us as being an area of major risk. The Puget Sound area is another area of major risk, and it's important at this point for us to look at what constitutes risk. Risk is the product of four different factors. It's the frequency of an event times the probability of that event times the number of people potentially affected by that event times the severity, the effects expected. So for example, if we talk about severity, building collapse, infrastructure being destroyed, people killed, we may have the potential for very large earthquakes to occur in very remote areas, but the risk from that isn't as great. There's not as many people affected, the damage is not as great. One of the reasons that the Puget Sound area shows up as being of high risk is because there's a large concentration of people there and resources there as well. And one of the things that frightened the Puget Sound area about the Kobe earthquake was that Kobe, Japan is one of the major port areas for the country of Japan, just as the Puget Sound area is a major port area. So the threats that we see, the potential risk that we see, come not only from my house being destroyed or my place of employment being damaged, but the potential impact that it will have on a much larger community, whether that's just the surrounding state, or whether that's the people in Iowa whose cars are shipped in through Seattle and Tacoma into the country. And so we can see that this comes as no surprise to us for Western California to be an area of major risk, but the Puget Sound is also another area of major risk. This is the Rockies. Yeah, we got earthquakes in the Rockies. We can't explain why in plate tectonics terms, but we do. And then there's a few other places that come as a tremendous surprise to people. The largest earthquake believed to have ever hit the lower 48 states during settlement post-1620, post-15, whatever, in terms of settlement of whites in this area was the earthquake which occurred in New Madrid, Missouri, 1810, 1811. Actually, there were a couple of them. Hard to explain, we're not at a plate boundary there. Another of the largest earthquakes experienced was in Charleston, South Carolina. Now we have to remember, though, that we have settled this part of the country 300 years ago. We hadn't settled this part of the country 300 years ago, so people didn't experience that 9 that the geologic community believes took place out there. And another place where a fairly large earthquake was reported in 1765, I think it was very close to Boston. But these are small, isolated areas based on really only an event which occurred in very isolated fashion. These areas instead are areas where the frequency is greater, the probability is greater, we can explain why, and then the number of people and the infrastructure impacted is dramatic. I can't stop talking, so I run over again. Just one last slide to show you, so we're not without risk here. If you come here in the winter, what is the risk here?
Avalanches.
And if you've ever been up on the upper tailing piles or been up to the top of the Honeymoon Heights Trail, you have a perfect view of the path of avalanches. This is the village that we're all in, the old miners' village. Winston Camp was up here, and there were 2 avalanche chutes. It came down. You can see that by the growth of much younger trees here and by the cleared area where the avalanches travel down. In fact, it was very carefully planned when they placed Winston Camp to be on the other side of the avalanche chutes. You may have heard as you came up, there are a tremendous number of avalanche chutes down the road from here. And great risk. Okay, I'll stop. I know people have questions. A couple other books to plug. Roadside Geology of Washington, over there in the bookstore, and a book about another kind of event in this area called Cataclysms on the Columbia. When following the Ice Age, Lake Missoula burst its dam and carved those channelized scab lands and all the coulees that we see in Eastern Washington. Go check out the books. Yes?
You didn't mention the Olympics. Why is that? The Olympic Range.
And what about them?
You
where they came from? They're believed to have been block of material added on to the state of Washington, added on.
Sea floor. Don't think there's any volcano action?
No. There's a lot of volcanic material, but that was scraped off the seafloor and added on to the top. David always does.
Yeah. If we have a 9-0 from this one cubic plate, would it be occurring offshore? And if so, then what would the damage be in the Puget Sound region? Or would it occur more below us?
Probably not, not so much offshore, just slightly offshore. The epicenter is not likely to be very far offshore, and the 9s are more likely to occur out at the coast rather than beneath the Puget Sound area. But let me tell you about the Mexico City earthquake of 1985. The epicenter for that was on the coast. And the most damage was Mexico City. Partly because Mexico City sits on an old lake bed that just shook like a bowl full of jelly.
If you can specify epicenter that well, that is location horizontally and vertically, then what's the model for it? Is it a girder rock, a particular piece that broke, or is it really just something that's small?
Oh, I see your question. Can you say actually where it was that, and the term geologists use is the rupture, where these 2 plates experienced movement and separation.
Right.
You can after the fact.
Right, but then what's the model? Is it a finite size piece, like some chunk the size of the kingdom that breaks, or is it a whole bunch of smaller things, or?
Well, it's some stretch of the plate boundary having experienced slip. We can usually specify it in one dimension. We can, in that we can say sort of what length of that plate boundary experience slip. Not very well what width. And we can say what depth it was along that path. After the fact, we wish we could do it ahead of time.
How concerned should we be that most of downtown Seattle is built on fill?
Yes. The Loma Prieta earthquake was a perfect example. The Mission District of San Francisco did not exist prior to the 1906 earthquake. It is the result of the fill of all the debris from the 1906 earthquake having been piled into the bay, and then they built buildings on top. And where was the greatest damage in San Francisco?
Can you and do other geologists hypothesize about the cause of the New Madrid earthquake or other quakes, or Salt Lake City or whatever, which aren't on a fault between plates?
No, Salt Lake City and the area west from there through Nevada, we can describe pretty well. It's an area where the continent, for some reason, is under a certain amount of tension. And another one of John McPhee's books is Basin and Range, where he describes the results of the tension in that area. And we're getting little blocks moving up and down relative to one another. So Nevada, Utah, we don't have a problem with. New Madrid, you know, we have ancient continental material there. Obviously, that ancient continental material experienced relative motion between parts of it, thank you, through time, and all geologists can hypothesize and actually begin to delineate is ancient faults in that material. We cannot offer any explanation for why there would have been movement along those faults, except potentially the tremendous weight of the Mississippi River and its deposits, and you know, that weight from above causing shifts down beneath the surface. Geologists wish they could. I mean, that's why you can create a risk map that says that the western part of the U.S. is at risk. The risk map for the east is very difficult to say how large should those areas be that we've delineated for risk.
Is Yellowstone in amongst the area for Salt Lake City?
Well, Yellowstone's different yet again. Yellowstone's the site of a hot spot, this localized source of magma coming up to the surface. Something very different going on at Yellowstone.
What did you say was the estimated height of the mountain that was at Crater Lake?
I don't know if I have that note here with me today. Yes, I think the estimate was for something slightly higher. Maybe it was about 15,000 feet.
I think around 15,000, I remember.
Yes?
Why did they call it the electron ball? Where did the names come from?
I can't answer that for you. I mean local names of things.
It doesn't have anything to do with electrons.
No, there is a dam on the river called the Electron Dam, and I don't know if they...
It's
the town of Electron, that's true. There is the town of Electron. Osceola, I don't think it's the town of Osceola. I'm not sure where that came from.